Today, I would love to present Eve Jourdain. She is a postdoctor and a co-founder of Norwegian Orca Survey, a nonprofit research organization in northern Norway. Her research focuses on foraging ecology, population dynamics, and the health status of Norwegian sea killer whales. In this episode, we will talk about the conservation work that she do. We will talk about the tools that they use on the orcas to get data, and also get a clarity of what ecotypes the Norwegian sea killer whales are, and even more. So here we go, taking us to her world in the research field on killer whales with Dr. Eve Jourdain. Big welcome to Eve Jourdain.
Yes, hi. Very happy to be here.
I'm very happy that you're here. Can you just please present yourself with your own words?
Right. Today I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Oslo. So I am working on Norwegian killer whales. More specifically, I'm working on a big project, which involves also other students and a PhD candidate. And altogether, we are trying to investigate the effect of multiple stressors on killer whales, both at the individual level and on the population as a whole. So that's the current project, and that builds upon the data that have been collected by Norwegian Orca Survey for the past years. So for people who don't know, Norwegian Orca Survey is a nonprofit research organization, which we established back in 2014 in Norway. So my partner and I have been running this nonprofit for several years now. And the goal with this nonprofit is to maintain some efforts at sea all year round, really in all seasons, to document the killer whales that are around. And we try to identify who they are, you know, how often they return, how many are they, what are they feeding on, and what threats they face.
Yeah, so when we come into the killer whales that are living in the Norwegian sea waters, what ecotypes is it?
So that's a very interesting and complicated question. A lot of people want to get a clear answer as to, you know, what ecotype they are. And I think about 10 years ago, there was this paper published that categorized basically two main ecotypes in the North Atlantic. That would be the type one and the type two. And the type one would be the killer whales of Iceland and Norway, which feed mainly on herring. However, after this paper was published, of course, more paper did new investigations. It's been clearly shown that both in Iceland, Norway, and also in Scotland, it's a bit more complex dietary patterns. So we've got some killer whale families, you know, going for herring and potentially only herring. But then we've got others that might switch from herring to other fish resources in different seasons. And then we've got some groups that also include marine mammals in their diet, like seals, for example. So it is not just black and white, you know, we can't just put them in boxes. It's not as clear a distinction as you would have in the Pacific, for example. So the North Atlantic is really a mosaic of dietary patterns. And because of this, we can't really tell this is one ecotype, this is another one. There's probably a gradient of, you know, dietary patterns and potentially even ecotypes.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. And it needs to be, you know, further investigation and also probably collaboration across the different locations, Iceland, Scotland, Norway, to fully understand what this is about, and maybe even across the North Atlantic all the way to Greenland and Canadian Arctic.
So would you say that these are sort of different ecotypes, or like how would you explain that?
I don't think we know today, and I've been talking to the person, Andy Foote, who's been doing this research, mainly doing the research on ecotypes in North Atlantic, and he would agree, you know, that with all the recent findings, you know, that within the classification of those ecotypes one and two, there is further complexity. So I would say today that, you know, Norwegian killer whales, they are still, you know, part of what we call ecotype one, mainly associating with herring. But then you have, it's very complicated within this ecotype with groups, basically including different preys in various proportions. And each group has their own diet.
It's very interesting. So Norwegian sea killer whales, they move both between coastal waters and offshore waters. And so then they follow the seasonal spring spawning herring that overwinters in coastal waters. But I'm very curious about the movement patterns. Where are they going after the winter season in northern Norway? Where are they going?
So During winter, as you said, they are in north of Norway because the herring is there. So the herring spans, or this Norwegian spawning herring, which is the largest of all herring stocks in Norway, is a massive stock. So it's a huge amount of food for the whales, which triggers the whales to also come into the fjords and stick where the herring is, because they've got plenty of food for 2-3 months. And then when the sun returns in January, that's the signal for the herring to start the migration and head towards the spawning ground. And those spawning grounds, they are south of Norway, or let's say off the central coast of Norway. So by January sometime, the herring starts the migration and it goes south. And that's when the whales also take off, and suddenly, you know, they vanish and those fjords become empty again. So we know for a fact that those killer whales, they would follow the herring south. So that's been shown, you know, with photo identification, so resighting of whales that were photographed in the north, and also some tags that were deployed on some killer whales. So that's some work that was done at the University of Tromsø. So there is good evidence for this. And then after the spawning is over, the herring goes offshore, and so the whales also follow the herring offshore. But again, because not all the killer whales do specialize on herring the entire year. There are other movement patterns probably that we don't know about, you know. So there are indications of killer whales seen actually in the Barents Sea, for example. So what are they feeding on up there, and why do they go the opposite direction compared to the other whales? That's a mystery. But it is more complex than just having all the killer whales doing the same thing at the same time.
Yeah, I understand. It's very, very interesting to follow the killer whales, how they move, everything about them. And so you're using different sort of data technology, in order to follow the killer whales. Which technology do you use?
All right, so starting with the most important tool we are using in our research is photo identification. So yeah. Cameras, you know, to get high-res photos so that we can distinguish the scars and any features on the dorsal fin area so that we can identify every single individual, catalog them, and, you know, log the sightings of when and where and with who they were seen. So this database is the foundation of everything we're doing today. Just because
it's like the most helpful.
Yes, because it provides so much information. And then, for example, if you get other types of data, for example, you get to observe a predation event, maybe they are killing a seal, you put this in relation with their IDs. So you know, okay, those whales actually feed on seals. And over time, maybe this repeats itself. And you're like, oh, wait a minute, it's always the same whales, you know, feeding on seals. And then you get to understand, okay, there are patterns, they have dietary preferences, you know. And so this is really interesting. And we log all this. So we've got a quite good knowledge of those individuals. You can also document the new calves, you know, with a camera. So you identify all the adults, and then you get like, okay, this little one just popped up and is a newborn from this year. So this is really cool. And this can be, you know, translated into or converted into data, which you use to model the population dynamic or demography and see how well they are doing. So this, I would say, is the most important. And then we've got biopsy sampling. So we use a rifle to collect some, it's a 1.5 centimeters, maybe 2 centimeters long sample. So we get this sample using a dart, which we launch with a rifle. And then you need to retrieve the dart, and we extract the tiny piece of skin and blubber.
How do you do that? How do you get the sample, the biopsy sampling?
Yeah, so it is with a rifle. So it's basically, I mean, it's like you would do with hunting, you know, but it's not hunting them, obviously. So we shoot them, and we try to target below the dorsal fin area, because that's where most blubber is. And we want to make sure we don't hurt them. So the best is to do, you know, where they have a very thick fat blubber layer. And for them, it's probably just like a I don't know, mosquito bite, you know, so they can, you know, they just do a little flinch and usually they just don't react more than that. And then we preserve the sample, we freeze it minus 20 or minus 80, depending on the analysis we want to do. And then into this, you can, you know, you can look at genetics so that you know who is related to who. You can look into dietary markers, which will tell you whether this whale is entirely feeding on fish or if maybe it includes also marine mammals. So you get different signals in the tissues. Mm-hmm. You can also measure pollution levels, which is very important, of course, in terms of conservation. You can look at hormones. Yeah, it's a lot you can investigate just out of a tiny piece of tissue. So this is, I guess, also very important tool we're using. And of course, we put this in relation with the photo ID data. So then you get even more information about each individual whale. And then I would say drones is also very important. It really has evolved a lot and you can really achieve a lot. So you can get those aerial images of the whales, which will tell you how fit they are, you know, how fat they are. So you get an idea of how healthy they are in a way. And you can also look at behavior, get the confirmation maybe of how many individuals are in the group. It's really a lot you can do also with drone images. That's something we use as well. And then I would say maybe the fourth one would be we deploy some tags, not at the moment, but we have in the past years. And we prefer the tags with suction cups just because they don't hurt the animals. They are not invasive. So you deploy them with a long pole. So, you know, you need to kind of drift close to them. And if they accept you, you know, close enough, you manage to just put it on and literally just sticks on with four suction cups. And then you have also sensors and even sometimes a camera on the tag. So you get the view from the killer whale. And then you can, you know, with the sensors, you can, it's like a puzzle. You can really put everything together and get a 3D image of what they are doing underwater and how they hunt and what speed and all this. So it's also really, really useful.
That's very interesting. Very cool that you guys are also, sometimes you can put like cameras on the back of the killer whales, right? So you can see when they dive, more of their diving and stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
It is really cool. The first time we retrieved one of those tags and we looked at the footage, which was 4K. It was, you know, mind blowing. And I believe we are actually the very first people who deployed any of those, you know, camera tags on Norwegian killer whales. So, you know, we've got the view of the entire like herring bowl and you saw all the killer whales around and, you know, it was just really amazing. Totally different view, you know, something you've never seen before. So this was actually featured in Blue Planet 2, if you've seen it. So all the images from the killer whale, you know, that's actually a deployment we made for BBC for that documentary.
Yeah, that's very, very cool. It's like a feeling of being with the killer whale, swimming with, also like sitting. I don't know how to explain, but it must be a very cool experience to see.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely. Yeah,
be with them.
It's like, yeah, they are taking us with them so that we can get to see, you know, what's going on under the surface.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Which tool is the most helpful from photo ID, biopsy sampling, tags and drones? Which one is the most helpful, would you say?
Well, I am a big fan and believer in photo ID, just because over time, this is what will allow you or enable you to monitor this population and how good they are doing or if something is wrong. So if you only take tags or biopsies or even, you know, random drone images on the long term, there's nothing you can get. You know, you will get a glimpse of what's happening now, you know, with those samples or deployments you've got, but that's about it. It's interesting, but on the long term, it doesn't tell you anything. So what I like with the photo ID, and now we are collaborating with people who started photo identification studies back in the 80s. So we've got over three decades of sighting history for some of those whales, you know, and it really tells you a lot. And this is really the tool, you know, to estimate abundance, you know, their survival, how often they reproduce, the survival of the calves. And those are the parameters that are really crucial when you want to assess how good or not good a population of animals is doing. So in terms of conservation and management, this is the most important to me.
Yeah. And you guys are also having citizen science. Can you just please shortly just explain what is that, citizen science?
Citizen science is actually a big part of what we're doing. And again, it is also linked to photo ID. So the thing is that we are based in Andenes and we also do some seasonal field work in Tromsø. So we kind of try to move, you know, where the whales are or where we know there are seasonal peaks. But obviously...
And Andenes is in the north of Norway, northern Norway, and Tromsø as well.
Yes, so that's 69 degrees north. So it's like way north in the Arctic Norway. So it's really a lot happening there and in all seasons. So it's definitely worth it, you know, to be there and based there all year round. However, as I said, not all the whales are sticking to the same location at the same time. So, you know, there is more to it. And while we are up north, other whales might be, you know, doing something in south of Norway, but we are not there. To get the complete story and to get to monitor all those animals that are part of the same population, we need help. So we have tried, you know, through, we have published the catalog so anyone can actually go through the ID catalog of Norwegian killer whales. It's online, it's public. People get understanding of why it is important to do this and how it works. How do you actually recognize those whales? And it is an invitation for the public to also contribute their own images to the project, so that we can get an idea of what's happening in those other fjords, because we are not there. And I think still those animals should also be monitored and be part of the big study we're doing. So I think we've got something, it's actually not taking off as quick as other countries, I think, just because originally in Norway, maybe people were not so keen on whales, at least some years back. It is getting better. And now in some places where the whales show up on a regular basis, people get really excited and they really want to know, oh, are they the same whales as we saw last year at the same time of the year? So then we try to step in and explain, you know, yes, we've got some photos, and yes, we're able to tell you that it is always the same group returning to your fjord, and people really like it. And we get, in return, we get more and more people contributing images. And so for some areas, we've never been there, but we have a very good ID of what whales are there, just thanks to citizen science over the years, which is really cool.
That must be very helpful as well for you and for them as well, that it goes hand in hand. Very helpful.
Yeah, we do the science and we educate the public, which is a win-win. And it's also fun, you know, if you do something on your own, it's not so fun. But when you're able to share it with people and involve people, and you get this common excitement, it's really cool. Yeah.
So I understand, like, the interest for killer whales has been increasing very much. Like, so many people, I thought, like, that I would be one of few who love killer whales, but obviously I'm very, very not. So the interest is very increasing so much. Which is also interesting. What would be your best advice for a person who wants to contribute to marine conservation?
Well, so I think it's really important to care for species, obviously, and, you know, to know what's there and what threats they may face. And I think the best way to, you know, raise awareness is, of course, to use those species that are very iconic and popular, like the killer whale. You know, you kind of raise awareness for the oceans and all this. However, I think more and more I become aware of this myself. You know, we live in a society where everything we do on a daily basis impact the oceans. It's just that we don't realize it. But, you know, how much waste you are producing, how you buy your everyday things, you know, from your food to your clothing. I mean, all this has a global impact. Mm-hmm. And I think things are going the wrong way today globally because we do things the way we do things. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, sometimes we feel sorry or we worry for certain species because, you know, there are those different threats they are facing and that are easy to identify, like overfishing, maybe they are bycaught in fishing nets. And then there is pollution, of course. And then you have captures and this kind of thing. But that's not it. And that's probably actually a small part of it. You know, like if you look at pollution levels in the ocean, this is like we are all responsible.
Yeah.
This is because we are part of this, you know, society. So I think it's sometimes it's interesting to, you know, just take a step back and realize that, yeah, we are all responsible. And every day, what can you do to make things better? For example, over the past 2 years, I've been more sensitive to, you know, for example, buying less stuff, because I feel like, you know, we are pushed to buy things constantly, you know, and of course, it's very tempting, you know, you also want to go shopping and this and that. But there's this trend with being minimalist and you know, kind of watch more what you are. And I think that's really something to think about, because if everybody was doing this,
it can be peaceful as well.
Yeah. So I think in terms of conservation, this is actually something that everybody can and should do, you know, just to think of your everyday actions that can make a difference if everybody does it.
Yeah. Awesome. And also, what would be your best advice for someone who wants to do a similar career as yours? Because I can imagine that so many people look up to you guys and this is their dream, like myself, you know, yeah, so killer whales is many people's dreams and stuff like that. So what would be your best advice to someone who wants to do a similar career as yours?
Wow. Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't think there is one way to get there. So I think the bottom line, you know, after all those years and achieving what I did achieve, would say, you know, it's important to follow your dreams and believe. If it is something you are, you know, you is meaningful to you and you believe in, you should never, you know, hear or listen to the people telling you, you know, there's no jobs there or whatever. You need to be hardworking, of course, but I think, you know, if you're convinced of something, this is what you want to do, and you have this strong feeling like, you know, this is for you, you've got to follow it. You know, eventually things will fall into place. And I'm not saying it's easy, you know, and it's still not easy, right? I have this, now I'm a postdoc, which is a 4-year contract at the university. And the academic field is really tough because it's a lot of short-term contracts and you constantly have to get new funding in to continue what you're doing. But, you know, this is how it is. And, you know, it's part of it. So, but again, I just, you know, I have to believe and enjoy the ride. A lot of people tell me this at the university, and that's true. Enjoy and believe in what you're doing, and it will be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The last question, and that would be, what is the most breathtaking event that you've ever seen in your life, according to the ocean, killer whales or Vladimir?
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this. I mean, we've experienced a few very interesting things with the whales at sea, but I think also it is very special when you get the connection with a specific individual.
Yeah,
and that happened with Vladimir. He's not a killer whale, he's a beluga whale, but it was one of the most amazing experiences I had in my life, and also to be able to help him, this poor whale, you know. So I felt like, okay, you know, I was really doing something that was helping, you know. It was really meaningful. And then I think, you know, because when you are at sea, you see the whales, they are there, but you don't get, you know, eye contact with them or anything. So in that sense, the experience with Vladimir was special. And yeah, probably something, I mean, hopefully it will not happen again with any other whale, but you know, you're aware that this is a one-time experience in your life, and you got to be there, and that was really amazing. I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, it saved his life.
Yeah, I guess we did some good job also with locals, you know, and Lindsay, a friend and colleague who was helping on site, you know, we were a lot of people on the team trying to make a difference so that he would be safe and get what he needed at the time, and he's still alive.
Surely, can you just explain who Vladimir is?
Yeah, so Vladimir, I guess he's known as the Russian spy whale, as the media called him at the time. So he appeared, he's a beluga whale who appeared with a harness around his chest northern Norway. So just outside Hammerfest, all the way north, actually further north than Tromsø. And I think the fisheries in Norway, they released him from the harness, but then he wouldn't go anywhere. So he actually just, you know, decided to stick around, and he was in the harbor of Hammerfest for 3 months. But, you know, monitoring him showed that, first of all, he was quite slim, so his body condition was not great. And he was not showing any signs of feeding at all. He was just logging most of the time, just seeking contact with people, doing tricks like responding to hand signals. And it was very obvious, of course, that he had been under human care before. And so because I used to work in a marine park in marine land in France. And so I do know, you know, how those animals are being cared for. And it was very obvious to me maybe that this whale was actually dependent on humans for his food, you know, and if he had been under human care, we had no idea if, you know, whether he was captured as a young whale or whether he was born in captivity. And if so, maybe he had no clue about, you know, hunting. So we had to intervene just because I think 2 weeks without, it's been 2 weeks in the harbor and literally no one showed up to investigate the situation. So this whale was just there and it was a lot in the media about it. But as a former marine mammal caretaker, I thought, you know, I can go and see and assess the situation and see if he needs help. And so I did. And it was obvious that, you know, he needed nutritional support. So we established a feeding program and SeaWorld actually supported our actions because, you know, you also need advice from vets who are specialized in marine mammals, and those experts, they are sitting in those marine parks. So we got a lot of supports there, and you know, all this together, we were actually able to make a good story out of it. And so he's still alive today, and the good news is that, you know, we were flexible with the amount of food we were giving him, and over time he actually got more and more interested in live fish. And he ended up feeding himself, and he actually took off after nearly 3 months of care in Hammerfest. So we know today that he's able to feed himself and he's totally independent, but he's still seeking contact with people, of course, because that's what he knows, but at least he's not relying on people for his food. So he gets a chance at survival and a fair one. So it was cool. It was a happy story. At least we did what we could.
What an amazing story to help a beluga like you did. Awesome. Thank you so much, Eve. How can people read more about your work, or is there anything that you would like to say?
Anyone can find us on the internet. So you just, we have an official website, norwegianorcasurvey.no. We also have the Norwegian Orca ID catalog. So you just Google that and you'll find it. Yeah, we're also on Instagram, Facebook. I mean, nothing special, I guess, just to think of, you know, the few things I mentioned, our everyday actions, and remember that it's not only what you see that seems to be, you know, direct threats, but we are all responsible with our everyday things. So if we care for the oceans and the animals, let's question things a little bit and see what we can do better. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was really nice to be here. And I hope maybe this podcast inspires more people to care for the ocean and killer whales.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Eve. If you would like to support their organization, you can buy very nice bracelets from the Norwegian Orca Survey. That way, you will support the orca research. If you want to know more about that, I will put the link in the episode description. So thank you, and I'm wishing you all a great day. Bye!